Hey everybody, my name is Alex, and this is Lunchbox Radio. Now, before we get into it proper, I just wanted to remind everybody, and I've been reminding everybody this whole week, including you'll hear on the news show, I remind you of this also, that I will be taking off, that this whole show will cease production between the 27th of December and the 16th of January, because I'm going on a big old vacation to Japan. Now, I've mentioned this before, but I will maybe put some stuff out in the meantime. Like, I got all the stuff to do it, finally. Like, I have a portable mic, but I wanted a cable to be able to connect it to my iPad, since I currently don't have a laptop. I do everything via a desktop and an iPad Pro, because that's really all I need. But, I'm clearly not taking my Mac Studio. I'm not unplugging my Mac Studio and hauling it all over Japan with me. That's unhinged. I'm taking my iPad, a USB-C to USB-C cable, and my travel mic. And that's how I will be posting content if or when I post content from Japan. So just keep an eye on the feed. I'm not going to promise anything, because I just kind of want to have a good time in Japan with myself, and also I want to have a good time in Japan with Kie. Hi, Kie. I'll see you on the 5th. But hilariously, I had a really unique experience in just like my fandom. So first off, and this will get into what we're talking about this week. But first off, I have learned to hate a new thing in fandom, and that's a lovely little web service called Qt. And if you have no idea what Qt is, first off, God bless you. You are living the best life. If you do know what Qt is, you may know it from such things as trying to get a badge on opening day, during the first hours of friggin' the Anime NYC badge sales. You may know it from going to a museum, possibly. I know it from two places now. I know it from trying to get a badge from Anime NYC. I tried the moment badges went on sale. And also, that meant that I couldn't get a three-day badge. I had to get 3 one-day badges. I had to get a badge for each day, not the triple pass, not the like 3-day pass. I had to get one pass for each day, which was fine. Like, I'm an adult, I have money, but also it just kind of sucks. Like, if you see me doing that, just like be like, hey bud, how about you take one of these instead? Like, how about you take the thing you clearly wanted instead? No, I had to buy 3 badges. It sucks. And I'm sure that's a way they keep attendance down, so they can avoid, like, selling too many badges and breaking fire code in the Javits, which I'm sure it's not a great fucking thing to do. But on that note, and that, by the way, that's with them moving to August, the Anime NYC moving to August, and so they could use the entire Javits Center, because up until now, they've been using anywhere from a third of the Javits Center to 2/3 of the Javits Center. Now they're just using the whole kit and caboodle. There has always been an empty part of the Javits Center. And I'm not saying, like, something else is happening in there. I'm saying it has been empty, which is really suspect to me in a way that I'm like, just pay the extra attendance and, like, use the whole... Anyway, so they're moving, and that still happened. But when I was at Anime NYC, there was this conundrum of a choice that I don't think if the Japan Society had picked this would have happened. Could choose a date, this would have happened. And that was on the very first night of Anime NYC, I think it was September 17th, there was an opportunity, if you remember, which I am a member of the Japan Society. I'm actually currently not. I let my membership expire. I'm going to renew it when I get back from Japan. I figured I'd spend that $60 in Japan first. Instead of joining the Japan Society, that feels counterintuitive in a way. Like, I'm going to take 60,000 yen or like 75,000 yen away from myself, away from my trip, so I can join the society to support the culture that I'm going to experience. It's insane. So I'm like, no, I'll renew this when I get back. It's not super pressing. I can always get that membership. It's not a big deal. But in any event, because I'm a Japan Society member, I get all kinds of opportunities to like go see things just before they happen otherwise. And this happens with any kind of membership thing. Like, part of the deal with the Met Gala is like they all get to see that year's costume exhibit early. Like, that's part of it. It's not all of it, certainly, but it's part of it. And like, so like they throw parties at they throw art openings at the Japan Society. I've been to a bunch of those. They have screenings, they have premieres, and the premiere that was happening on the 17th was for this week's topic, which we're going to jump into right now, and that is a little film from Studio Ghibli and Hayao Miyazaki in particular, 2023, called The Boy and the Heron, or How Do You Live?
Anime Considered. Lunchbox Radio.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, the first thing I want to talk about here is actually fairly interesting, because the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that this film was, what's the best word for it? The first thing I want to talk about is the fact that this film was not widely publicized leading up to its release in Japan. It just kind of like, people got a poster and then a couple screenshots and it was out, and all of Ghibli was doing was like, no, we're not going to tell you shit about this. Go see it. And they were very unceremoniously like, just like, no, we released it. Go see the thing. We're not going to like send you a screener. We're going to make you go to the theater, shithead. And so, first off, let me say, I have a lot of respect for that. I just have a lot of respect for that. Because this is not like some indie darling. To us anime heads, it could feel like an indie darling film. If we think like the outside of otakudom doesn't know what we're on about. But believe me, it's not. Hayao Miyazaki is like considered the Walt Disney of Japan. When people speak, when he speaks, people listen, kind of thing. And there's been because of the new Studio Ghibli movie out, there's been all kinds of like interview clips with him specifically about Studio Ghibli floating around. One in which he's like, "Yeah, Studio Ghibli will fall apart, but that's fine. Things fall apart." Like, and it's like seen as being so sad. But I'm like, you mean legendarily cranky anime grandpa get off my lawn screams at clouds Miyazaki is kind of pessimistic about the existence of his own studio after he's done, or after he leaves or dies or whatever? Surprise, surprise. But like, that was like a thing on on an anime fan page thing that I follow on Instagram. I was just like, this proved nothing. Like, if you've been paying attention, Miyazaki has been just in the worst mood since, like, 1982, and we all just kind of are used to it at this point. But probably the most weirdly impressive thing about this film is in the credits. And that's because oftentimes these films are primarily the work of one studio, but they enlist other studios for assistance. Like they're like, oh, this is a huge movie, we can't do these specific cuts, or we can't handle this specific aspect of it by ourselves, but we know somebody who can, so they get on the phone and they, you know, call this animator, this studio, or that studio, and like, hey, can you handle doing this? A great example of this is in Shirobako. If you watch Shirobako, you'll see that a lot of the main character of that job is just driving shit to people. And that's because those animators are independent animators who are working with that studio. They are not necessarily part of that studio. And that's kind of the creative professional world in a nutshell anyway. When I was a freelance creative in New York City, I never worked for one. I worked for a couple of times. I worked for one person for a sustained period of time. But for most of my time, I was freelance. I was a gun for hire. I was a wandering samurai, a ronin of sorts in the industry, as lots of people are. Like, I got hired by a giant ad firm publicist to go work on the Cadillac ad campaign for, like, 2 or 3 months or something. I got hired by a firm called Creative Block. I got hired by them multiple times, usually around Christmas, to just, like, come in and do creative work for them. And one of those was an internal video for AstraZeneca. Another one was some app layout stuff. And another one was just a kidney cancer drug campaign that, like, I was just in the room and everybody was like, we can't figure this out. Give it to Alex. And I just did it. And I, like, handed it off. I'm like, here, defend my work. Go forth. Which the creative director and I had a really good working and just kind of, like, chummy relationship. We were a little bit, like, dumb and dumber in that role, but it was really great. But my point is that, like I said, when Hayao Miyazaki speaks, people listen. And if you look at the animation assistance section of the credits, this thing reads like a who's who of, holy fuck, don't these people have better things to be doing than working on this? Than doing, like, the CGI for a couple scenes of, like, Studio 4C. Don't you have other stuff, like, other more pressing things than working on the CGI for these couple of scenes in this film? Well, I guess the old man did say he had a movie and somebody did ask you, so good on you. Same thing with Production IG. The only one that makes a lot of sense is Studio Ponoc. Split, if you've ever seen a Studio Ponoc film, there's only been two. The Witch one and the Little Heroes short one. I think those are the only ones they've done. They split off of Studio Ghibli when Studio Ghibli announces they'd be ramping down. When Studio Ghibli kind of lied that they'd be ramping down because everybody's favorite anime, cranky anime grandpa was pretending he was going to retire again, only for real this time. I'm not old Japanese man chair, I promise. But in any event, so that gives you an idea of like the magnitude of this thing and why they weren't advertising it in Japan. Because everybody was going to go see this fucking thing. It was not going to be hard. Case in point, and the reason why I brought up Kewitt is I went to see this movie after making my reservations for the Studio Ghibli Museum in Japan online, which was like a one-to-one as harrowing, only more so actually, because I had to take Kie into account because we had specific days when we wanted to go or Kie could go and I wanted to go with her. So we were planning on going on one of 2 days. We ended up going on a completely different day because that was the day when she could guaranteed go and when I could get tickets. But my point is that this film didn't need an introduction. It's certainly not in Japan. But here it super got one. But the other thing that's weird about second runs of movies, and what I mean by second runs of movies is like other country premieres of movies, is the whole thing already exists. Like you haven't cut a you don't just have a trailer cut. The whole thing is just there for people. And so by the time it's even close to premiering in America, people have the film. And on the 17th, I could have gone to Japan Society to see a special members-only screening of The Boy and the Heron. I was obviously going to Anime NYC and was like, I'll do that later. But not only that, but like I could have gone to see it on the 17th and like two more days after that. It was not hard to go see this movie. I ended up going to see it on opening day because I thought that was fair. On official opening day. Like, I could have gone to see it on on September 17th. I could have gone to see it on at least one more time. I think it was September 22nd. I ended up going to see it on December 8th with the rest of the world. With the rest of America. But I just thought it was really interesting that, like, this movie's prestigious enough where they're having, like, these limited edition, these limited time screenings that, like, if you're just on the right mailing list or you're part of the right club, you could just go see this movie at any point between, like, early December, early, probably not even early September, early November and, like, now. So just know that when you're, like, thinking, like, I have to wait. You can usually look around and maybe get your way into some like screen, a special screening or something if you're determined about it. But like I said, I had a really unique experience of reserving the tickets for the museum and then going to see this film. Actually, going to see this film and then reserving the tickets for the museum. And I'll be honest, I'm not. Well, before we get to that, let me take a break and you can hear from I, and she gives you a lovely plot synopsis of this brand new Studio Ghibli feature film. So take it away, I.
Absolutely. The Boy and the Heron is a fantastical film set during the Pacific War. It tells the story of a young boy named Mahito Maki, who, after the death of his mother, discovers an abandoned tower in his new town. This tower serves as a gateway to a mystical world, where he encounters a talking gray heron. The story unfolds as Mahito, longing for his mother, embarks on an adventure in a realm where the boundaries between the living and the dead blur, and where death ceases and life takes a new form. The narrative begins with the tragic death of Mahito's mother in a hospital fire in Tokyo. This event leads to Mahito relocating to the countryside with his distant father, Shoichi, and a new stepmother, Natsuko, who is pregnant and also the sister of Mahito's deceased mother. In this backdrop of familial change and the turmoil of war, Mahito's father, Seiichi, who runs a munitions factory, remarries Hisako's younger sister, Natsuko. Mahito is then evacuated to his maternal grandparents' house, along with the factory. The film weaves a poignant tale of loss, discovery, and the thin line between life and death, portrayed through the eyes of a young boy in a time of great upheaval and change.
Thank you, Ai. Now, let's get into what I thought about the thing. Every Studio Ghibli movie in recent years have been much lighter in comparison to this. Yes, you have standouts like Grave of the Fireflies or Princess Kaguya, but by and large, what people think about Studio Ghibli is they probably think about Spirited Away. Or you think about another standout. Oftentimes, including mine, people's first Studio Ghibli movie, which is specifically Princess Mononoke. And if you're going to put The Boy and the Heron, which I'm just going to call it The Boy and the Heron for the entire show, although How Do You Live is a much more apt title. We'll get to all that in a second. If you're going to put The Boy and the Heron in like a Studio Ghibli pocket, it would go in the same pocket as something like Nausicaa, Princess Mononoke, that kind of stuff. It's much it is whimsical. It's whimsical and actually kind of almost some of the same ways as Princess Mononoke is. But it is much darker. It is working with much darker, almost horror images at some point, especially regarding the heron with fucking human teeth, which is so, so unsettling. But the point is that it sits alongside something like Princess Mononoke, Grave of the Fireflies, Nausicaa, in that it is having a heavier conversation about a heavier topic than the grab bagness that can kind of occur in something like Spirited Away. Spirited Away is much less about one thing and more about a bunch of things that Hayao Miyazaki was thinking about alongside making that film. The difference here, though, is I think that something like Nausicaa or something like certainly Grave of the Fireflies or something like definitely Princess Mononoke hits the mark a lot more. And what I mean is, it's that... And the big grading curve that we're not accounting for there is that Princess Mononoke and Nausicaa are both about the environment and both about, like, environmentalism, preserving, like, we have a duty to preserve the earth or the earth will kill us. Hayao Miyazaki understands something about sustainability that lots of people who are into sustainability don't even get, and that is that if we fuck this up, nothing happens to the earth. The earth keeps spinning. The earth does not give a shit. If we fuck this up, we kill ourselves. If we fuck this up, we convince the earth that we are to be murdered. And that is so... That's such a different place to understand environmentalism from than throw your paper bags out to protect the turtles. Like, yeah, will some turtles die? Yes. But will their bodies, like, decompose and release methane in the water, therefore heating it and fucking... This is not real. None of this is science. Do not judge this on science. Therefore, diluting the polar ice caps and drowning us all? Also, yes. Like... And The thing with this film in particular is that it's tackling a much more complex, deeply emotional, not that environmentalism can't be complex and deeply emotional, but much more aware, like, human-centered topic. And that is, and by the way, spoiler alert for The Boy and the Heron. If you haven't seen it, it's in theaters. You can go see it. But, and it's definitely in wide fucking release. But this film is dealing with the idea of coping after someone's death. And what that looks like and how alien it can feel in the moment and how strange and otherworldly it can feel. But so my problem here is that Hayao Miyazaki and Studio Ghibli took a really Studio Ghibli approach to this, and I'm not sure it totally works. I'm not sure it totally matters in the way that they think it does. It is as whimsical and as magical on almost every level as something like Spirited Away. There's clearly this like understanding of like, okay, this is how we light up the same parts of the brain that Spirited Away did, but they were trying to get, they're trying to get somewhere different with it, and it doesn't always work. And parts of the movie, in every part of the movie, is beautiful. There are parts that are haunting. There are parts that are as haunting as the first time you saw Princess Mononoke. There are parts that are as, like, wistful and beautiful as, or as adorable as they're. So, I had a conversation with Kie about this because I had to call her to make sure she could go to the museum on a certain day before I made the reservation. And she said, and she's like, yeah, sure, do it. I'm like, cool, I'll text you when I have the tickets. If I get the tickets, let's go. And I said this to her, and she totally agreed, because she also saw it. Because, once again, this is the kind of, like, appointment viewing that they didn't even need to advertise in Japan. But the thing I said was, like, it was beautiful, but the plot was really disconnected. The plot feels like it doesn't have the connective tissue it needs. And it's a bunch of ideas that don't sit well next to each other all the time. And then, like I said, it's not to say it's not a beautiful film. It's absolutely a beautiful film. There are moments that are haunting and beautiful and incredible, and you're like, oh my god. But the thing is that the whole film doesn't hang together. And not only doesn't it hang together, it doesn't. It doesn't super. It's like it's not all talking to each other. But it's also not talking of what the points aren't stating themselves clearly in a way. And this is really interesting because up until now, in most Miyazaki movies, that's not true. The other one where it doesn't super, where stuff isn't super clear is Ponyo. Ponyo is a little bit of a mess. It's oftentimes people's least favorite Miyazaki film for a reason. It's just kind of,
it just kind of, it gets by being cute as hell. This film, especially with the addition of the Heron, who is just a nightmare. Just a nightmare creature. It doesn't, it doesn't really have that, it doesn't have that cuteness at all times. And the, but the other thing that it does, that's a kind of a point of the movie, is when it introduces, like, the maximum amount of cuteness, which is in the form of the warawara, which is, if you've seen this film and you know what the warawara are, you'll know what I mean by this. I saw those things pop up on screen, and I was like, holy shit, they're going to sell so many of those things. Because the warawara are these little, like, they're little spirits, and they're supposed to be unborn, like, the spirits of unborn children. And the movie super just said, oh, this is what, to its main character, Maito, it says, oh, this is where you came from. You used to be one of these little guys. They go up in the, they float up in the sky to be born. And you're like, oh, fuck, those are unborn children. that's a lot. They're so cute, though. And then as soon as they start floating up into the sky, fucking pelicans come to devour them. And you're like, holy shit, this movie had no chill. And that's the moment at which you're like supposed to understand, like, oh, this movie has no chill. This movie is supposed to kind of feel like working through grief on lots of people's different levels. You see from a bunch of different angles. You see Mahito is the main character. You experience him working through his grief. And then you see Mahito's father, clearly, like, doing his best trying to keep it together for his kid, but, like, making some very widow dad moves in the fucking process. And so this movie is taking place in the middle of, I don't think it's, there'll be people who tell you it's at the end of the, World War II. I don't believe it is. I mentioned, I think it's like in like the Pacific War or something, but it's clearly in the middle of some war because they are still producing plane parts. Like, they're still producing things that people need for planes to go, like, fly and fight. So that's your hint that the war isn't over. But also, like, they bring the plane parts to the house at some point, which is just the most I'm grieving and I don't know what to do signifier I've seen in a film. It's wild. Let's bring all these very valuable, very fragile things up this hill into this old house with all of these old women. Just leave them here for a period of days. Because that's great. That's fantastic judgment. But my point is that this movie really wants to kind of show this cycle of healing and regression, almost like the tide of water constantly in the film. Until it doesn't. So, essentially, Mahito goes into the tower that I mentioned, looking for his father's new wife, who is his mother's, who died in a hospital fire. Who died in a hospital fire caused by a firebombing. Sister. So part of the coping journey that the father is on is that, like, he married his deceased wife's sister, which is a wild fucking choice. It's a choice that lots of men across history have made in some way or another, for some reason or another. But that doesn't mean it doesn't feel fucked to the kid. If there was a kid involved there, that's gotta feel like a weird nightmare. You married my aunt after my mom died? You fucking emotional hobo. And you can see in the beginning of the movie that, like, Mahito's going fucking through it. He's clearly going through grief. He lashes out at his new classmates. He makes it seem like they beat him so he can at least get sympathy. But, like, he could have done a lot of things to make it seem like they beat him. But what he does, he picks up a rock and he bashes his skull in with it. And then just walks home with just giant gash on his head. And it's just like, it's the whole film feels like a lot, and it feels intentionally at first like there's this hope that Maito's mother is alive. And the film is immediately like, what are you talking about? No, we're not gonna play undo death games. Except they totally do. They introduce this teenage version of his mother. And it becomes a way for him to say goodbye one last time when he has to leave. But the film also gives him this opportunity to stay in this world and basically run it. But the plot is like, you should probably leave, my guy. Like, this is not a help. Sitting in this weird old man's chair and playing with blocks under this large ominous stone. Not a great emotional choice for you. And just like I said, a lot of the movie's haunting, a lot of the hauntingness is just that crow, that heron has human teeth and speaks like the fucking hobgoblin from fucking. So when the heron is in like his human form, I get big Danny DeVito vibes. When the heron is in heron form, I get big Willem Dafoe via the Green Goblin vibes. It's so upsetting. It's so unhinged. But it's also like, when Maito encounters this heron, he instantly fucking hates it. It's clearly torturing him. But the heron's also like, hey, your mom's alive, come with me, I'll take you to her. And then completely fucking lies to him to get him ensnared in this world so this old man can ask him to be his replacement. And it's so much just constantly and all the time. But like I said to first Kie and now to you, the plot feels disconnected. It doesn't feel, don't get me wrong, is it a terrible movie? No. Is it like a great movie? Also no. It's kind of just okay. And not every movie has to be incredible. There are incredible moments about, like, the scene where basically him and his mother's sister, aka his stepmother, are, like, trying to reach each other through just piles of bandages and paper that, like, it feels like you're watching cursed videotape. It's wild. It's insane. It's so well done. It's just the magnitude of the amount of animation in that. It's like, holy shit. But those moments pass. And then you're left with the Parakeet King. The fucking, the Pelicans. The Warawara, who seem to survive on giant monster fish caught from the sea of the fucking afterlife. It's crazy town. But here's a really interesting thing. I went to see this movie, and I was talking actually to my mother about it, because my mother is the person who brought home, when I was like 12, she brought home, actually before I was 12, like when I was like 9 or something. Wait, earlier than you'd think. She brought home the VHS copy that I would eventually watch for Princess Mononoke. And that was a, like, eye-opener for me. It wasn't necessarily my first anime, I don't believe. It could have been. I've lost track over the years. But it left a mark that will never vanish. That is my favorite movie. I can recite it line for line. I love it. To death. Awesome. And this one just isn't, as, like I've said before, cohesive. It like, you get things like the Parakeet Empire, which is a great visual, but it, like, they don't. You get things like the Warawara, which are, like, the next step in the cuteness evolution of this studio in which it went from. Okay. We got the forest spirits. We got the soot sprites. And now we got the Warawara. We're just on the road to out-cuting Sanrio as hard as possible. But I absolutely checked, and at some point they did make Warawara plushies. They were all snapped up by people and are now on eBay for hundreds of dollars. which just made me and Kie sad when we were talking about it. Because I said, like, aren't those things cute as hell? I bet they'll sell a billion of them. And she was like, I haven't seen them on store shelves. I'm like, I definitely saw them. And I sent her a link. She's like, holy shit. I'm like, yeah. This is what it's like being a fucking nerd now. It sucks. And she was just like, I'm sorry. That blows. I'm like, yeah, it does. Almost solidifying the fact that we're going to go to the fucking gift shop for that fucking museum. But in any event, the film clearly has something to say. It's clearly saying something about, it's clearly in conversation about death and mourning and grieving and moving on. And I think that's the real, like, key to this film, is that it's not just about grieving a loss. It's about processing it and moving and being able at the end of that process to move forward from it. And the movie is a really great signal for this. After Maito's mother dies, they move away from Tokyo. Him and his father move away from Tokyo to live with his aunt / stepmother. His former aunt, current stepmother. And then at the end of the movie, they all leave that house and move back to Tokyo. So, like, even in the context of the movie, the physical place that tower is, that they're living, is like this holding area where everybody involved is processing the loss of this person they all cared about. And then once that is all done with, they, like, leave. I would relate this to Lady Eboshi losing her arm at the end of Princess Mononoke, And if you've seen enough anime, there's a lot of anime where like a character become disabled and they change because it's this very violent, active understanding of, oh, whatever I was doing forced me to sacrifice an arm. Like, something I was doing fucked me over so hard that the world took an arm. I should change. I've done some self-reflecting, and it turned out I was the bitch the whole time. which is very much like a thing that Lady Eboshi is going through at the end of that film. She's like, yeah, I super fucked up. We should start over and like make this, but for real and better. And in this film, the end of the film is very much like, okay, we've all like had a good cry. We've all processed our feelings, and now we're ready to take the next step forward. We realize that the pain we feel won't ever disappear, but it had dulled enough for us to like go back into our lives. And I think that this is also a really interesting movie to come out after a global pandemic. And because it's about processing loss, which is a thing that lots of people have had to either learn or reacquaint themselves with over the pandemic. And I think it's not an easy thing to like wrap your head around or try and talk about, but I think the film does successfully have the conversation about mourning and about closure and about like moving forward from a really bad place. So I can say that this is a successful movie, but also not a movie that's okay. This movie is a very successful, okay film. And does that mean I think that he shouldn't be making movies anymore? No. I just think that this particular one is odd. But they're not all going to be like constant bangers. Lots of people love Princess Mononoke, love Nausicaa, and are disappointed by like Howl's Moving Castle, or disappointed by Spirited Away, I'm sure. But the difference here is that this is in kind of the new Ghibli style. And just the parts don't all fit together. And I don't know what to do there. But on that note, if you like the show, new episodes happen every Wednesday and every Thursday. You can go listen to the previous Wednesday show, which is right before this. It's a anime news show in which I put together a fancy AI-read anime news broadcast. It's a couple minutes long. It's like story ad kind of thing. You can definitely go check that out to like bone up on your anime news for the week. And then the Thursday episodes are like this. They're me talking about a specific property or show or sometimes even manga. sorry, I'm getting over a cold. That's why I'm all horsey. But yeah, so if you like the show, definitely subscribe in whatever you're using to listen to me right now. And until next time, I've been Alex, and this has been Lunchbox Radio, and I'll talk to you later.